First Annual Research Symposium of the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis, May 25th to 27th, 1984, held at the Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation, Warm Springs, Georgia. Tape K201-1, welcome by J. Ellis Moran. Late Effects of Polio Clinical Description, presenter David O. Wickers.
Well, I'm Ellis Moran, the Executive Director of the Roosevelt Institute. We're delighted to have all of you with us today. We hope that this session will be as meaningful to each of you as we know it is going to be to us. Before I want to tell you a little bit about how we got into all of this, but there are some very key folks here at the Institute and others that have been involved in the planning of this symposium, and I want to introduce them to you. On my extreme left, standing up around the wall over here, is Marge Smith. Marge has been the person in-house that's coordinated all the details and worked here in working out the details of the program itself. Next to her is Glenn Crowder. Glenn, hold up your hand, because if any of you had any transportation problems, it was Glenn's fault. Turn this just a little bit. Then back in the back there is Bill Tomlin, who will be working with some of the audio visual and so forth, and has been working with Marge. And then standing in front of Bill is the really executive director of the Institute, and that's Beverly Bullock, my administrative assistant. And most of you have talked to Beverly, or your secretary, or your spouse, or someone has been talking to her. She has been responsible for trying to get all the tickets at the right place at the right time. And then Larry, most of you have met Larry, but Larry, if you would stand up. Larry is the medical director here at the Institute. We have been interested in trying to determine what is the appropriate program here at the Institute in reference to polio, but more importantly, what should be addressed in the bigger picture, if you will. And we have been struggling with this issue for a long time, and particularly in the last 4 years since the Institute has revitalized itself into a comprehensive rehabilitation program. Polio goes back a long time here, and if you will permit me, I would like to kind of bring you up to date on a little bit of the history. Most of you probably know it, but in case you don't, in 1924, this was the old Meriwether County Inn, and the person that owned the Meriwether County Inn at that time invited Franklin Roosevelt to come down to swim in the pools here that are fed by a spring that continues to function very well at a flow of about 900 gallons a minute at a temperature that varies from about 88 to 92 degrees and has a rather high mineral content in it. Mr. Roosevelt came down and spent several days here, and as a result of that experience, he determined that it was very easy to swim in the water. Partly because of the high mineral content and also because of the warmth of it, I guess. He felt like it was very beneficial. He became interested in developing something around the Meriwether County Inn and started inviting a lot of his other friends. The net results of that was that in 1927, he purchased the old Meriwether County Inn and some of the surrounding property with two-thirds of his personal wealth. A year later, he created the then Georgia Warm Springs Foundation, which started on a major effort to not only build the facility here, but to provide money for research that led to the development of the vaccines. This is not the first major symposium here, but it's only the second one. The first one was held during the development of the vaccine. They brought people in from all over to determine how best to distribute the vaccine and try to get it throughout the country. And at that time, again, they were struggling with some of the issues of looking at different ways to do things and trying to come up with some conclusions. Well, since that time, the facility continued to develop, and all of y'all know the story of polio better than I do, so I'm not going to go into that. But as it appeared that there was not a great need for programs working with polio, the program started to change in other directions. About 20 years ago, the state of Georgia, in cooperation with the Roosevelt or the Georgia Warm Springs Foundation, proceeded to build a vocational rehabilitation program adjacent to the medical unit, which is here. And a vocational unit is the brick buildings, and you will be given an opportunity. They are the red brick buildings, and these are the medical units in the white brick buildings. I don't know if there's anything symbolic about that or not. But they started operating the vocational unit, and the medical unit here provided services to them as appropriate. Then about 10 years ago, in fact, it'll be 10 years ago next month, the foundation gave the entire complex to the state of Georgia to develop a comprehensive rehab facility. There was a period of time in which about 5 or 6 years ago in which there was a considerable amount of discussion as to what the future of this facility should be. The net results of that was that the state decided to embark upon a major renovation of this facility and embark upon a major effort to develop a comprehensive rehabilitation facility that would have the capability of providing medical, vocational, and research type activities in the whole field of rehabilitation. During the past 4 years, well, at that time, it was also decided to combine all the programs under one administrative umbrella, and we created what is now called the Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation. But I must admit that everybody knows us as Warm Springs or the foundation, so that's kind of the way when you start talking to someone, if you say the Warm Springs or the foundation, you know what they're talking about. And then if you don't say that, they might not always know what you're talking about. So we're very comfortable with being called any of those things. Anyway, during the past 4 years, we have, with the help of the state of Georgia and the Georgia Warm Springs Foundation, which is now called the Roosevelt Warm Springs Foundation, we have embarked upon a major renovation of facilities and programs. And during the past 4 years, we have spent over $7 million in renovation of this facility. We're now embarking upon a major capital improvement program. It'll be a $61.5 million expansion program, working again with the Roosevelt Warm Springs Foundation and the state. We hope to develop a major facility here that will be of impressive scope, if you will. Not that it's not already, we think, impressive in scope. But it will give us an opportunity to get into some other activities, and particularly in the area of research. The first building in this new expansion program is a $11.5 million recreation, research, and conference center. And it will give us the capabilities of getting into research in a more detailed way, and at the same time provide us facilities to have symposiums like this and other conferences in which we can work together on addressing all of the needs of the disabled. We, very quickly, as we've talked over the last 3 or 4 years, we have struggled as to how to get together and what we should do and so forth. And through one of our good friends, Ernie Johnson, Laurel Halstead, who is the gentleman on my right, and all of you know him, I think, got in contact with me and said, hey, I believe we're working on some mutual concerns. Why don't we combine our efforts and see what we can work out? And we thought it was an excellent idea, and Laurel, along with David Weikers, David is right here. They all know you. Hold up your hand. The two of them joined us here at the Institute for a couple of days, and we continue to work on some ideas, and they are the ones that are really responsible for getting all of y'all together and determining the content of the program. We have been responsible for just carrying out the administrative details, and as I told them earlier, if you got any housekeeping questions, ask me. If you got any technical questions, ask them. And that's the way we will get through the week, or the weekend. Again, we are delighted to have you with us. There are two or three things, housekeeping kinds of things, that I would like to mention that would maybe you might be interested in. Some of you have your wives with you. I highly recommend a tour of the Callaway Gardens. It's beautiful, and they just about 2 months ago opened a major greenhouse complex over there that's just about as impressive as anything you'll see. Certainly would encourage that. If any of you have the desire to visit the Little White House, which is adjacent to our grounds here, we will be delighted to arrange that. We will need to have some advance notice in that for that. We have all of the we will have coffee and pastry here and fruit every morning, in the morning and as well as Sunday morning. If you have the need to, if you don't want to eat breakfast and come on over here, fine. If you want to eat breakfast at Callaway Garden, please feel free to do so and just put it on your tab over there, and we'll take care of it with the lodging expenses. Also, your wives or husbands are invited to the functions tonight and tomorrow night. Tonight we will have a cookout, which will be informal, down at the clubhouse on the golf course. And tomorrow night we will have a social hour at my home, which is here on the grounds, with a dinner to follow in Georgia Hall. But everyone is, your spouses are invited to attend. The one thing that we do need to know for tonight as a starter, does everyone here plan to attend the functions tonight? Everybody planning to attend? Now, how many, if you have someone that you're, or one or two or what have you, that will be coming with you, if you'll hold up your hand, we'll be able to get, you got two, three, four, five. Okay, Glenn, you can take this number here and add five and subtract two, and you got it. Do any of you have any questions you'd like to ask me? We're really excited about this. I appreciate all the work that David and Laurel have put into getting all of you here. We hope, as far as the Institute is concerned, as well as the concerns for those that have polio, that we will come out with some things that we will be wanting to address. One thing that I did fail to mention, that in our fundraising program, we do plan to establish a $30 million endowment fund, one of the priorities, or the top priority really, for the use of the funds for the endowment fund is in the area of research, and particularly in programs working with expanding our capability here as appropriate to work with the various programs for polio, and at the same time expand, make other services available as appropriate. We hope your stay will be comfortable. We encourage you to be, and if you want to be informal and loosen your tie, that is great. The coffee and the fruits will remain out there throughout the weekend, and just make yourself at home. One other thing, since a lot of you will be over here and won't be able to go back to the motel, we have two dressing rooms on either side, and if we designated which one is...
Yeah.
The men's room will be on this side and the ladies on this side, and we have towels and washcloths and what have you back there. And if you need to go, excuse me, go back and freshen up, please feel free to do so. And now I will turn the program over to Laurel. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ellis. Good morning and welcome to all of you from all across the United States, Canada, England, and Europe. Before we begin, I'd like to do just a few housekeeping tasks. The first, I think, is to spend just a minute or two to get to know each other. And I know there's going to be plenty of opportunity to mix, but I know some of you, but not all of you, and I'd like to be able to start putting names with faces. So maybe if we could just go around the room, if people would please say your name and where you're from. And if you can, please stand. Otherwise, just raise your hand. Let's start here.
I'll start by raising my hand. My name is Nancy Perkin.
Great. Glad to have all of you here. I should mention that there are a few people who are on your program who are unfortunately not here. Dr. Kurland is not here. He was hospitalized early this week. My understanding is it's not serious, but it has delayed his ability to get here. Dr. Herbert Schoenberg, who was going to join us, had surgery last month and was not feeling like he could make the trip. And Dr. Bengt Saltin is trapped in Australia and had difficulty arranging his air tickets to be here on time. Dr. Alba, I did not hear her name. Dr. Alba will be joining us later this evening. And I think Dr. Adair also is not with us. I would like just to take a moment before we get started to thank Ellis, who it looks like has slipped out the door, for all the support and help he has been in helping to arrange this program, and to Marge Smith and her staff. And I would also like to take this time publicly to express my deepest appreciation to the Warm Springs Foundation and the RGK Foundation of Austin, Texas, who have provided major financial funding to make this conference possible. In addition, there have been other contributors which are listed in your program. Our first speaker this morning is David O. Weekers, a clinical assistant professor at The Ohio State University. David's going to talk on the late effects of polio, a clinical description. Our plan in the presentations is twofold. One, to allow approximately 45 minutes per presentation, but hopefully with each of the speakers only using between 20 and 30 minutes for their presentation. We are therefore hoping that there will be at least 15 or more minutes per presentation for an open, free, and I hope, informative exchange. David.
Thank you, Laurel. It certainly is a pleasure to see the enthusiasm of this group, and I think we need to recognize one other group of people, and that is our spouses and families who have been so gracious in allowing us to slip away on this holiday weekend. I want to basically discuss this morning five cases that I've pulled from my patient load of post-polio patients to try to illustrate some of the problems and the variations in clinical presentation to begin some discussion and to kind of just set the stage for further discussion today. If you would be so kind to turn on the first slide there, Dr. Lieberson, just throw the switch in back. And can we have the lights? One of our goals of this symposia is to generate a lot of discussion and hopefully develop some ideas, ways of approaching the problems of the post-polio patient, and certainly, hopefully, that we can get a lot of interchange of communication amongst ourselves. So at any time during the presentations, I think when major questions arise, certainly I do not mind being interrupted. And the more discussion I feel that we can generate at this symposia, possibly the more answers we can begin to approach and hopefully generate some conclusions. The first case that I want to present to you today is that of a 47-year-old physician who suffered polio at the age of 18. The patient required a respirator assistance for a period of time, several weeks, and then had a fairly slow, steady recovery to the point where approximately 3 years later, they had normal strength of both lower extremities, but continued to have a lot of residual weakness of the upper extremities. The patient was a very active and athletic individual. He did not have a great deal of function in one upper extremity, but his left upper extremity was of fairly good strength. He was a very active mountain climber, as well as participating in tennis and squash. In 1970, however, he began to notice weakness of his left arm, which was his really only functioning upper extremity, and he actually stopped playing tennis and squash. Then approximately 2 years ago, began noting numbness and tingling in the left lower extremity. And this numbness and tingling progressed and appeared to be in the S1 dermatome. He therefore sought medical attention, had a CAT scan, a myelogram, a complete workup for a radiculopathy, and really the workup was very inconclusive. A small defect on myelogram was seen at L5S1 that was of questionable significance. The patient then began a series of abdominal strengthening exercises and did fairly well without too much problem until approximately 8 months later when he felt that he was developing some definite weakness of the lower extremity. He was also noting a lot of cramps, fasciculations that were now more present in that extremity, and he began another workup, again, which was essentially negative. The patient then began to notice somewhat of a fatigue phenomenon that would occur in the late to mid-afternoon, whereby there would be the inability to concentrate, just a general fatigue, hot-cold type sensations that would come in flashes. And then this began to become cyclic. It was at this time that I examined the patient and noted that there was indeed some weakness of the left lower extremity that was not present before on prior examinations. Electrical studies were performed of the anterior tibialis on this side, and some studies that we'll talk about later called macro EMG revealed that approximately 90% of the motor units in that muscle were very large and reinnervated motor units. So this patient has not had a great deal of change since that time, but there has been some definite documentation of a progression of weakness in this individual's lower extremity. Case number two is a 49-year-old white female who had polio very early at age two. This patient basically had involvement of the lower extremities only and did not require a respirator. She underwent a rehabilitation program and by the age of six was manually muscle tested, and we have records at this age that demonstrates normal muscles, normal muscular strength in both lower extremities. This patient walked a mile and a half four times a day to and from school without difficulty all of her younger years, and had essentially no complaints, although she could never really run. The patient underwent a series of surgical procedures for muscle transfers in the uppers and had no problems with that. And it wasn't until about at the age of 32 that she began just to notice the fact that she was having a little more fatigue than she would anticipate having. She continued to work on a full-time basis and really had no problems until approximately 8 months ago, when she was complaining of weakness of what was her good side, her right leg. She had had a chronic problem with dislocation of the patella on the left side and was unsure as to whether or not the left leg was actually changing because of the chronic problems with the knee. But there was no question that she felt that her good side, which was her right side, was actually getting weaker. I examined her and noted that indeed, in comparison to her prior manual muscle testing examinations, that she had a grade F, or 3 over 5, ankle everter, and a grade G, or MRC scale, 4 over 5, ankle dorsiflexor. I prescribed a plastic posterior leaf spring orthosis for this lady, which stabilized her ankle, gave her a much more efficient ambulation or gait pattern, and she basically continued to work less fatigued and having no further problems, except that there was definite progression of weakness of what was her good right side. Case number three is a young white female who had polio at the age of 9 months. It is of interest that she walked as a young child prior to the onset of polio and then was not capable of walking again until the age of three, at this time with braces and bilateral crutches. She did require a respirator during her acute phases of polio. The patient continued to ambulate with crutches and long leg braces until age 15, at which time she underwent multiple transfer procedures throughout both lower extremities. And by the end of those procedures, she was able to walk using only a right long leg brace. The patient went through a fairly normal development stage. She has had two children, one who is eight, another who is two. And she works in a very stressful office situation, tremendous amounts of deadlines that must be met, and a lot of tension and stress in the office. She stated that approximately 3 years ago, she began noting numbness and tingling in her left foot. She was felt to have a radiculopathy, was admitted to the hospital, had a normal myelogram, a normal CAT scan, and a normal neurological examination as far as her sensory system was concerned, but she continued to have a tremendous amount of weakness as a residual from the polio throughout both lower extremities, and it became difficult to determine whether or not she was actually having any change in her muscle strength in comparison to her prior years. The patient was treated with physical therapy and TNS because the majority of her symptoms were actually pain. She improved markedly and did well until approximately a year ago. At that time, she had a reoccurrence of symptoms in her left leg associated with left hip and back discomfort. The patient had always had a scoliosis, and there was no change in the scoliosis. It was of interest, however, that the reoccurrence of her discomfort, her pain, and her tingling in the left leg occurred at a time during 1 week when there were many family stress-related problems. Her mother was hospitalized. Her sister graduated from school and left the country, taking a job in another country. Her brother suffered a neck injury and was hospitalized. Her husband left her, and she was forced to move with her two young children. This all occurred in the week prior to the onset of her symptoms, or the reoccurrence of her symptoms. When I examined the patient several months later, she was found to have excruciating muscle soreness pain. And she had trigger points in essentially every muscle of her body, very similar to the type of trigger points that is seen as in myofascial pain. Most of the trigger points in the muscles were in the lower extremities, the gluteus medius, the gluteus maximus, the tensor fascia lata, the gastroc soleus, and the mid-belly of the anterior tibialis. Her left side seemed to be much more tender than her right. Her manual muscle testing did not appear to be greatly altered from a muscle testing that had been taken several years before, except for this extreme soreness. One point of extreme interest was the fact that her right anterior tibialis muscle, which was very tender to palpation, was actually a grade 0 or MRC scale 0 over 5. So we had a muscle, the anterior tibialis, that essentially had no functional activity, which was also extremely tender to palpation, as were the other muscles of her lower extremity on the opposite side. This patient was treated with progressive stretching exercises and did extremely well. She changed jobs, moved out of this stressful situation. Her husband came back, her life reorganized, and she had resolution of the major portion of all of her pain, and her muscle soreness markedly resolved. Case number 4 is a 48-year-old school teacher who had polio at the age of 12. All limbs were affected. He did not require a respirator assistance, however, during his acute phase. He underwent a complete rehabilitation program and walked again at the age of 4 using bilateral long leg braces and crutches. He essentially had no functional return in his lower extremities that would allow him to be able to lose the braces. And he developed a fairly severe scoliosis that required surgical fusion twice. Once for the lower areas, and also he was fused up into the cervical and thoracic regions. He also underwent ankle fusions bilaterally. He really had no problems, taught school on a daily basis. He taught physics and mathematics and was extremely active at the blackboard and would move about as he lectured to his class. Approximately 2 years ago, he began noting low back discomfort that appeared to be centered around the apex of his curve in the mid-thoracic region. It was of interest that he had no complaints of muscle fatigue. He had no complaints of muscle weakness, only mid-back discomfort. His upper extremity strength remained essentially normal. This gentleman was treated with physical therapy in the form of ultrasound to his painful area, and then he began doing some gravity traction. X-rays were taken, which were suggestive of some further compression of the concave side of his curve, but it was not definitive. He was placed on anti-inflammatory medication, and most importantly, it had been noted that he had gained approximately 30 pounds over a period of 10 years. He began a very aggressive weight reduction diet. Over a period then of about 2 months, he lost 30 pounds of weight, completed about 1 month of physical therapy on an outpatient basis, and his symptoms resolved. The final case is that of a 42-year-old female who had polio at the age of 6. She had involvement of both arms and no involvement of the lower extremities. She was a housewife for many years, and then about 4 years ago decided to return to school and get a graduate degree. About 1 year ago, she began having intermittent neck stiffness. And then 3 months ago, she developed acute left shoulder pain. At this time, she felt that in spite of the fact that her left arm was moderately weak as a result of the polio, that her weakness had become markedly progressed. She was unable to abduct the left arm when she could perform that activity just several months ago. I saw her at that time. Her x-rays of the cervical spine were normal, and she had a grade P or MRC scale 2 over 5 in the deltoid, and a grade F plus or 3 plus over 5 in the left biceps. The remainder of the musculature of that extremity were normal except for her hand intrinsics, which she had felt were always weak, and those were a grade G or 4 over 5. I performed an electromyographic examination which demonstrated fibrillation potentials and positive sharp waves in the paraspinal muscles at C5 and C6, and in the deltoid, biceps, and triceps muscles. Of interest was the fact that the motor units were of normal size in the deltoid and biceps, those few that were recruited, whereas the muscles in the triceps, the motor units in the triceps, were of extremely long duration and highly polyphasic. The patient, I felt, had a cervical radiculopathy, as her Sperling's maneuver was also positive. I placed her on 3 weeks of outpatient traction, and when I saw her back, she had loss of pain, but her weakness progressed. I then saw her approximately 2 months ago after keeping her on home traction, and the strength returned to normal in her deltoid and biceps, but her hand intrinsic muscles still remain weak at a grade 4 over 5. So these five cases demonstrate some of the medical problems that face the post-polio patient. Certainly, the first two cases demonstrate or illustrate true objective progression of weakness in patients who had had polio. The third case presents the problem of muscle pain, which this patient demonstrated. This muscle pain was very similar to the myofascial or fibrositis syndrome that is so commonly seen in everyday practice of physical medicine. Case number 4 was that of a patient who had a severe scoliosis who had required fusion, who developed back pain, and who had had a significant weight increase. When loss of the weight and normal physical therapy measures resolved his pain. And case number 5 was that of a typical C5 radiculopathy occurring in a patient who had had poliomyelitis. Now, which one of these cases represents the post-polio syndrome? Or are they all the post-polio syndrome? Or should we even bother talking about this term post-polio syndrome, because I'm not sure what that means? But we can discuss that later. I think of most concern to us are these patients who do have true progression of weakness, and not to allow us to feel like we've discovered anything new, this was demonstrated in 1875, and we're having the 111th anniversary, I suppose, of the discovery of this problem, not only by one individual, but also by Raymond and Charcot, of another individual who had had polio, who had overworked themselves in a very heavy job and developed progressive weakness. And a third case in 1875. So obviously this occurred some time ago. In 1903, Potts did a review article of the medical literature at that time and found 36 cases. 28 of these people demonstrated progressive muscular atrophy, which was the term that they used to describe these individuals who had definite progression of weakness. Two of these people, he felt, after reviewing the literature, were the simultaneous occurrence of ALS. Two of these people were felt to have an inflammation or a myelitis of some sort, and four of these 36 cases were felt to have had another type of polio or a second attack of the virus of a different type. If we break down 33 cases that had secondary atrophy, 18 of those were in the previously affected limb, 7 of those were in the different limb but on the same side, 5 were in the same limb on the opposite side, and 2 were in a different limb on the opposite side, and 1 just showed generalized progression of symptoms. So there's nothing new about this problem, but certainly we are being confronted with it frequently in this country. Now, the report that most people think about is the one that Dr. Molnar and his associates did from the Mayo Clinic, where they used the term Form-Frust ALS, which may have created many problems in terminology, and we can discuss that as well. But they seem to think that the progression of muscular atrophy was found in those few patients who had had an initially severe and overwhelming infection early on in young childhood. Now, how do these factors enter into the progression of weakness? Certainly, most of these people are in their middle ages and are suffering from the same problems that everyone else in midlife in this country face. And how do we look at these factors? How do we evaluate whether or not some of these do not enter into the problem? Thank you.
Before we start discussion, I'd like to make one other announcement. We have made arrangements with Infomedics of California to tape the entire proceedings, and each of you will receive a full complimentary set of tapes at the end of the proceeding, which will be a verbatim transcript for your own private use. But to make that more meaningful, we are going to ask that the speakers, when they are asked questions, please repeat the questions so that the questions will appear on the tapes. So David, if you would please repeat the questions.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your tape over now to continue listening on side two.